session number 24573, Reel 5.
Mr. Darcy, Reel 5. Was there much else to the training at Osprey?
Well, yes, it was what these days I think they call a total immersion business. We worked all day, every day, on all aspects of submarine hunting. The tactical side of it, the practical side of the equipment that we were using, and then the actual use of it, which was very important to be able to handle the oscillator and transmission devices and the recorders. And of course also we had what they called an attack teacher, where you could have simulated situations where everybody took a turn either being the commanding officer or the anti-submarine control officer or even the ratings using the equipment, so that we could have hands-on experience of attacking submarines.
Do you remember much about how they worked, the simulations?
Well, you had a... How shall I say? You had something rather like the plot that I spoke about earlier on board ships. And they could simulate a situation where you could be in the ASDIC cabinet, which is what it was called, and you could be using the equipment, scanning the ocean, and then you could pick up an echo. And then you could proceed exactly as if you were doing an attack at sea. And the results of at the end of it all could be examined and calculated, and you could be told, between the lot of you, whether you'd made a good attack or a bad attack, and what you'd done wrong, and why you'd done it wrong, and what you should have done. This was quite sophisticated equipment. It even gave you the different sort of echoes that you get when a submarine is coming towards you as from when it's going away from you. This is called Doppler, the Doppler effect.
Can you describe? I know it's difficult to describe a sound. What was the Doppler effect?
Very roughly, if you hit a submarine broadside on, and it was sort of going along on a parallel course with you, for example, the pitch of the echo would be just about the same as the pitch of the transmission. But if the submarine was coming towards you, the echo was at a higher level of sound. If the submarine was going away from you, the echo was at a lower level of sound. This was what was known as the Doppler effect. And you had to be able to distinguish between higher or lower echoes in order to be able to tell the commanding officer whether the submarine was approaching or going away, and all that sort of information. And all this was built into these attack teachers, and you could have a real good go several times over, and you could do it time after time after time, and do a complete attack from picking up the echo to actually dropping the depth charges.
Did they actually go to sea with you to try it with a real submarine?
We're coming to that.
Sorry.
We're coming to that. This period that I'm talking about, at I'm fairly sure it was called HMS Osprey, was all indoors stuff. But it was very, very concentrated, and it covered every conceivable aspect of submarine hunting.
Now, that was from July 43 through to...
About July for about two or three weeks, perhaps, something like that.
So just in July, basically?
Yes, it might have been the end of June, beginning of July, something like that, I think. Anyway, afterwards, after we'd finished with this particular phase of the training, we were all then sent down the Clyde to the Mull of Kintyre, to a place called Campbelltown. And at Campbelltown, the Navy had got an old destroyer, which really wasn't much use for anything else, and a very old submarine, which was completely not any use for anything else. And with these two vessels, we used to go to sea every day and actually attack, do attacks, finding the submarine, and hunting it, making dummy attacks on it, and having it all checked and calibrated by the experts to see whether we'd done well or badly. And this was very interesting, because everybody had to have a go at everything. We were all young officers, but we all had to act as the submarine, ASDIC ratings. We had to act as the ASDIC ratings. We had to act as the conning officer. Had to act as the commanding officer. All the various parts in the attack on a submarine, we all had to take turns at doing all of them. And it was very interesting. And in fact, we also had on this destroyer, the name of which I really can't remember now, but anyway, as well as the ability to drop depth charges, which of course we only did in a virtual manner, we also had a thing called a hedgehog. Now, a hedgehog was a different type of weapon to a depth charge altogether. A hedgehog was what was known as an ATW, that is to say, an ahead-throwing weapon. And the hedgehog was mounted on the forecastle of the ship, and it consisted of 24 mortars, you could describe them as mortars, I suppose, which were mounted on spigots, on 24 spigots. And when the firing instruction was given, these things fired in pairs. They couldn't fire all 24 at once, otherwise they'd go straight through the deck. But they used to go, it's rather like the dial on a telephone. The firing sequence was rather like when you dialed zero on a telephone and let the thing go, it went boom, 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 back to zero. And that's exactly how this thing worked. And the 24 bombs or mortars were fired ahead of the ship to fall in a big circle about 200 yards ahead of the ship. And these things, these bombs, fell through the sea in this great big circle. And the plan was that if one of them, only one of them, hit the submarine, it would explode, and it would also explode all the others in sympathy. And usually the idea was if you hit a submarine with a hedgehog, you didn't usually get any survivors. It usually blew the thing to pieces. That was the plan. But anyway, we had this hedgehog on this old destroyer, and it was fitted with dummy bombs, and so we could actually fire these things. And if you really did a good job, you'd finish up with the submarine coming to the surface a little later, waving one of these bombs that had fallen into the conning tower, just to show that you'd made a good attack. Anyway, we did this down at Campbelltown for something like 2 weeks, I should think, day after day. So we were, having had the theory, we now had had the practice, and we knew how to operate the equipment and hopefully to get the best results from it. And at the end of it all, we were told that we had qualified as what they called ASCOs, which stands for anti-submarine control officers. And that sooner or later, we would be appointed to a ship in that capacity. So, after the whole episode of HMS Osprey, we went on a very short leave. And within a few days, I suppose, I was received a message to say that I was to report to Londonderry. And I was to join a ship called HMS Van Sittert as an officer under training. So I made my way to Londonderry, and I found the ship. Now, she was an old V&W, what they call a V&W destroyer, called the Van Sittert. For information, in the Navy she apparently was known as Vancy Tart, the Fancy Tart. Needless to say. And I joined her purely to do one trip across the Atlantic and back again, to get some actual, what you might call, hands-on experience of the sort of thing that I was going to be involved in at a later time. So we eventually set off from Londonderry.
Now, could you give us a bit more of a description of the ship? Because we're quite interested in these old V&Ws. Yeah,
oh, sure, yes, all right.
What was she like? Can you sort of take me through the ship?
She's quite an old-fashioned vessel. They weren't very comfortable ships for anybody, certainly not for the ratings who lived up forward. The mess decks were very wet, Pardon me. The mess decks were very wet. There was always water coming into the place. They were never dry. They had to sleep in their hammocks and on the mess tables and on the deck and anywhere else where they could find to get their heads down. She had had this ship had had one funnel removed, and the depth torpedo tubes had also been removed to make room for more depth charges on the upper deck to turn her into more of a convoy escort, an anti-submarine vessel. And frankly, I didn't like her. I wasn't comfortable in her at all. I didn't get on terribly well with the other officers.
Your accommodation? What was as an officer in training, the
accommodation I had was a cabin, a small officer's cabin in the officer's quarters aft, which was adequate enough. It had a bunk and a set of drawers and a hanging space where you could keep your stuff and not much else.
You didn't have to share, though.
No, I didn't, as it happened, because there was enough room. The feeding arrangements were not too bad, I suppose, but I wasn't comfortable in the ship. I didn't. The other officers, I think, resented having me there because I didn't belong to the ship. I wasn't part of the ship's company.
Now, explain this a bit more. How did they treat you? What was the reception?
Well,
why were they like this?
The attitude was, oh God, not another one of these bloody nuisances, you know, and I reacted to that in the way that you might imagine. I didn't like it myself too much, the whole proposition. But anyway, the captain was quite a nice bloke. I can't even remember his name, strangely enough. I can visualise him. He was a 2.5 Lieutenant Commander RN, and he was quite a nice bloke. But a lot of the other officers I found, they lived up well to the lower deck description of them as pigs. Anyway, we set off eventually from Londonderry, and we picked up this convoy that was heading west. And we were part of a group called B7.
An escort group?
Yeah, an escort group called B7. And B7 group was under the command of a man called Commander Gretton, who I believe later became an admiral. I'm not 100% certain of this, but I think he went on to greater things. He was a very good escort group commander. He made the ships do an awful lot of drilling, of dashing around from one part of the convoy to the other in support of each other and hunting for submarines and doing gun drill and all sorts of things. And it was very good, I must say. He was a very demanding man. I never actually met him. But I could see that he was running his group as a very, very tight group indeed.
And he actually had an impact then, beyond, you know...
Oh, yes, he did indeed. He was with us, of course, in his own ship. I'm trying to remember the name of his ship. It was another VNW. I think it might have been Vedette, but I'm not 100% certain of that.
Now, how did you settle into the shipboard routine? Because I mean, that's why you were going.
Yes,
you know?
that was quite interesting. They knew that I was intended to be an ASCO eventually, but the plan on this particular trip was to get me used to the whole proposition of watchkeeping duties and all the boring things that one has to do on a day-to-day basis in a ship. It's on convoy duty where you're not actually being attacked by any submarines. The weather was fair to middling, I suppose, pretty well all the way across. It wasn't very rough, and it was a big swell most of the time. We weren't attacked by any submarines, so I never actually saw any action or had to do any of the marvellous things they'd taught me to do.
So what was your routine? What was a typical day like?
Typical day was to do three watches. I was allocated as junior officer of the watch to another watchkeeping officer, a lieutenant, right? And when he was on watch, I was on watch, and we did the normal three-watch system. So it now, I know
it seems strange, but could you just explain for them the watch system?
Yes,
what it was?
Yeah, sure. The watch system was you did 4 hours on, and you had 8 hours off. But if you did that all the time, it would mean that you'd always have exactly the same watches every day. So to avoid that, they used to have a thing called the dog watches, which appeared between 4 o'clock, 1600 hours in the afternoon, and 2000 hours in the evening, which was divided into two watches of each of 2 hours. And these were called the first dog watch and the second dog watch, or last dog watch. And it simply meant that because there were now seven watches in the day instead of six, you did a different series of watches every 24 hours, which made life much more interesting in fact.
Now, as junior officer of the watch, attached to this other officer, what were your duties on watch?
Well, when you were on watch, you had to spend an awful lot of your time with a pair of binoculars, the old Barenstroud binoculars, glued to your eyes, looking at the sea. You had official lookouts on the bridge, both the port and starboard side of the bridge. There were sailors whose job was to act as lookouts, but the officers of the watch had to spend a lot of their time also looking through glasses to see if anything appeared on the water or in the water. At the same time, you had to watch the course and speed of the ship, and you had to watch its bearing in relation to the convoy. Every ship in the escort group was given a specific station in relation to the block of the convoy, and it was required that you should stay in that relationship at all times. So you were constantly watching the bearing of the other ships around you, both the other escorts and the ships in the convoy, to make sure that you stayed where you were meant to be. And very often you had to be detached from your place of duty to be sent whistling round the convoy to shout at some bloke who was lagging too far behind or who was getting out of position. And this was not very rewarding, because frequently these merchant service blokes didn't like being shouted at by chaps from naval ships, and didn't always want to do what they were told, but eventually they did. And it was very interesting, this sort of dashing around like a terrier or a sheepdog, I suppose, trying to round ships up and keep them in their proper position in the convoy formation. So that was the sort of thing that one did. So you were moving around some of the time. Other times you were staying where you had to be and making sure that you were in the proper relationship to other vessels. You had to watch your speed to make sure that you didn't get too far ahead or too far astern of where you were meant to be. Sometimes the convoy was put onto a zigzag course. And this was quite interesting, because it meant that every so many minutes you had to alter course an exact number of degrees to port or starboard, and then an exact number of minutes later you had to alter course yet again to the other direction, and you did a zigzag pattern out of a book of zigzag patterns, which would maintain your actual intended course but still do zigzagging both sides of it all the way along. This was to upset the aim of any submarines that might be lying in your path.
So there were many different patterns. It wasn't just...
Oh, yes, so you had a book of patterns, and the commanding officer, the bloke in charge of the convoy, the commodore, in conjunction with the commanding officer of the escort, would agree a particular zigzag pattern, and you'd be told to do pattern number 73 or number 26 or whatever it was, starting at X minutes past the hour or whatever, and then everybody did it. It was very good, actually. It was very interesting. Now, at the same time as this was going on, the ASDIC equipment was in constant use. The ASDIC equipment was on all the escorts, was constantly switched on and constantly sweeping the sea on both sides of the ship. You used to train the oscillator down the port side to 10 degrees above the beam, and then you would bring it up to right to dead ahead in 2.5 degree increments between transmissions. By now we were using automatic transmissions. We didn't have to transmit by hand or anything like that. The transmissions were sent out by the electrical equipment every 2.5 seconds, and the oscillator moved 2.5 degrees. And when you got to right ahead, you then went swept right the way down to 10 degrees above the starboard beam, and did exactly the same sequence of events, coming always from above the beam to right ahead, and left, right. And this was intended to give you as good a coverage of the sea as you could get with that particular ship. And with all the ships doing the same thing, the plan was that you, hopefully at least, would be able to pick up submarines within, below the surface, that is to say, up to a range of about a mile and a half, or just under a mile and a half.
Now, if you got a contact, you could stop this automatic sequence.
Could
break out and concentrate.
Absolutely. As soon as the ASDIC operator, the man operating the oscillator, as soon as he heard an echo, he would immediately notify the bridge, echo bearing X degrees. And then he would stop the sort of automatic transmission and go into controlled transmissions using controlling the direction of the oscillator himself. And his job always was to get the right-hand cutoff bearing and the left-hand cutoff of the target. And then the officer on the bridge would get the center bearing of that, of the median between the right edge and the left-hand edge of the submarine. You first of all had to identify it as a submarine. The identification was usually done by the anti-submarine control officer in conjunction with the senior ASDIC rating, who was known as the HSD, that is to say, Higher Submarine Detector. He was the senior man among the crew of ASDIC ratings, and he and the anti-submarine control officer would listen carefully to the echo, whatever it happened to be, and had to decide whether they thought it was a metallic echo and, in fact, a submarine. This was all part of what we had been taught about at Osprey and at Campbelltown. And it becomes a matter of judgment.
But presumably on this, you didn't encounter submarines.
No.
You'd still have, I presume, a number of false alarms, though.
Yes, very often you get echoes quite a lot of the time from shoals of fish. And I think occasionally whales and things like that, you know, because there's a lot of whales in the North Atlantic. And they're big items, they're big lumps. But they don't, fortunately, they don't give the sort of echo that you get from a metallic object. It's softer, it's not as sharp an echo as you get from a submarine. So you do get a certain number of these things going on all the time. But anyway, that went on 24 hours a day.
Now, what was it like on the bridge? I mean, what would you wear? It was summer, wasn't it?
It was summertime. But it's still quite chilly out in the North Atlantic. I mean, it seldom gets to sunbathing weather up there. Occasionally it does, but not very often.
So what was it like on the bridge? How would you spend the time? You're
looking and you're talking to each other and you're watching the compass a great deal of the time, making sure that the quartermaster is keeping the ship on its proper course, that the engine revolutions are the correct revolutions for the speed that you want. You're talking to your brother officer about all sorts of things relating to the ship, and very often not to the ship at all.
Now, in this particular case, your brother officer wouldn't be being particularly communicative.
Not really,
that,
no.
That's
right. He wasn't. I wish I could remember their faces and names better, but I really can't. I was only with them for a very short time, and this is now 55 years ago or something, and more than that, nearly 60 years ago, and I really can't remember who they were, but all I know is I wasn't very happy on there. But we talked. I mean, just about things in general, the war and...
So what would you be wearing?
Normally, I used to wear a pair of heavy trousers, my leather sea boots with oiled wool sea boot stockings, and a fairly heavy jersey of some description, and then a duffel coat on top of that. And then I used to wear my officer's cap. A lot of the time we just used to wear woolly hats on the bridge.
And would you talk to the seamen on the bridge?
Oh yes, but not to any great extent. Their job was very much to concentrate. You weren't really supposed to talk to them very much.
So you'd have the helmsman, the lookouts, and the Astigal.
The helmsman was down below in the wheelhouse. Yes, on the upper bridge, the watch is kept on the upper bridge, out in the open air. The helmsman is at the bottom end of a voice pipe. And you talk to him through the voice pipe. You'd tell him to alter course, you'd tell him to alter revolutions on the engines, give any steering instructions at all down the voice pipe to the helmsman, who changed. There used to probably be two or three blokes in every watch, and they used to take turns at actually holding the wheel and steering the ship. And they stood behind the wheel and watched the compass and watched the revs and did what they were told. And they spent the whole 4 hours doing that. That was the normal thing. Now, as well as all this on the bridge, you also had a signalman. You always had a signalman on the bridge. Because the signalman was the bloke who used the signal lamp, our 12-inch projectors, which were wonderful lamps, I must say, for signalling back and forth to any other ship in the convoy, whether it be one of the escorts or whether it was the Commodore or anybody else. And they could really used to send messages and receive messages. And any signals that were received by the radio office were brought up to the bridge by the radio people and given to the signalman of the watch, who put them on his clipboard and showed them to the officer of the watch, who would then decide if any action was needed as a result of that, whether to call the captain, for example, if there was something that required action on our part, you'd immediately call the captain. You'd call the captain in the event of anything unusual. He used to spend a great deal of his time on the bridge anyway, the captain. He was there an awful lot of the time. And when he was asleep, he used to sleep in a little thing called his sea cabin, which was at the back of the bridge. It was just a box almost, with a bunk in it, and he used to get whatever sleep he got in that place, and his food was brought up to him there. He hardly ever left the bridge, in fact, when we were at sea. And if you wanted him at any time of the day or night, you simply lifted his little voice pipe cover and called, "Captain, sir," and he'd be on the end of that voice pipe like a rat up a drain pipe. Absolutely amazing. They were very, very good. And I think all captains were exactly the same. They never really let go of the thing. They were always available for anything at all that was needed. So there you are. We had two officers of the watch. We had the signalman. And we had two bridge lookouts on the bridge. I can't remember whether on the Van Sittert we had a masthead lookout or not. We certainly did later on the Gore, but we'll come to that.